By definition, ambassadors are representatives of their sovereign and their nation. We have the privilege to discuss and represent our sovereign, Jesus Christ, and his kingdom for his glory. Join us as we seek him first. Welcome to Ambassador Talks.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Ambassador Talks. Ambassador Talks exists to glorify God by the pursuing of truth in God's Word and applying it to the issues and challenges facing the church today. I'm your host, Matt Baker, and with me as always is Nathan Phillips and our pastor, Robert Setzer. Ambassador Talks is brought to you by Ambassador Baptist Church of Hudson, North Carolina. For more information about the church, you can visit ambassadorbaptistchurch.org. This week's subject is something that involves literally every listener. We're talking about education. All of us have either gone through getting an education from all levels, beginning in kindergarten and going up through college, some with Christian college, some at secular universities, and even some in postgraduate studies, whether it be seminary or doctorate work. Our guest tonight is a member of our church and has been on with us before, but he makes an impact in the public school system by being a voice of reason to those who would try to explain some of the truth claims of the Bible away. He has the opportunity to lead Bible studies with some of his students, and he gets to be a great witness to them. He is Brian Thigpen, and he is our guest tonight. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
Now, you've been spending some time, Brian, in your Sunday school class talking about this subject that we're going to bring up here. And I'm not familiar with it as familiar as you are, and I imagine a large base of our listeners may not be familiar with it either, unless they're in the education community. Introduce this idea for us, if you will, of the confessing faculty.
Well, there's a website at this point called theconfessingfaculty.org, and you can go and look it up and see what it's all about. It's just about a one-page statement of confession and commitment. And at this point, over 1,000 faculty members from Christian colleges, from secular colleges, all professed Christians that have signed this document saying that they agree with it, they encourage it, and they want to try to do something about it. So I read through this document, and there was a lot of good stuff in there, some stuff that we ought to listen to and we ought to look to, and it's good biblical sound direction and help. But there are a number of things in here that are part of the common thread of today's conversation and current culture and the political buzzwords and ideas that were coming across that gave me pause and seemed to go perhaps astray from the gospel or from the basic Christian principles and Orthodox Christianity. And what gave me the pause is how many Christian, confessing Christian faculty signed this from across the United States. So obviously, it's not just secular or leftist people who are signing this. It's people from a mainstream Christianity that are signing this as well. What I'd like to do is just read a little bit from the intro of it, and then we can discuss some of the items that we find in here. At the beginning, it says, as Christian faculty members from a variety of academic institutions who share a common concern regarding the current social and political climate in the U.S., we offer the following statement. We hope to address our larger communities of faith as we all engage in dialogue, discernment, and action. We thank the faculty and staff of North Park Theological Seminary and Westmont College for graciously allowing us to adopt and build on their statements. Now, I'll read the first statement of this actual confession, and then we'll talk about some of the particulars. It says, the United States has experienced a contentious election and post-election season marked by fear, polarization, and violence. And I don't think any of us would disagree with that statement. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to say, the current political climate reveals long-standing national sins. And that's something we may talk about, is what qualifies something as a national sin. But these long-standing national sins of racism, misogyny, nativism, and great economic disparity. I'll define some of those for you because I had to look them up to figure out what they actually mean. As Christian faculty members of institutions of higher education who represent varying degrees of privilege and power, but do not represent those institutions in this document, and that's important. There's quite a number of signers from Wheaton College and from some other established Orthodox Christian universities. They don't represent the university. They're individuals signing this. We, the undersigned, join our voices with those who are most vulnerable. I'll just briefly define a couple of those words. This goes on. There's about five other paragraphs to this. This is the introduction. I think we all understand what racism is. Misogyny, I had to look it up. It comes from two Greek words put together, and it means to hate women. So they're addressing the longstanding national sin, which means it continues to today, rampant hatred of women, nativism, and great economic disparity is the other sin. So if any of you have a comment or a thought at this point, you can throw in, but I've got plenty to say.
You're rolling pretty good.
I'm going to say this, and it's going to sound a little bit sarcastic. And I believe that a lot of our comments may sound a little bit sarcastic tonight, because some of this is just, it's a little bit ridiculous. And I'm going to say this. If we're going to join our voices with those who are most vulnerable, it's a letter, a statement by which you put your name on a piece of paper. Is that the best way to do it? If you're going to join forces and join voices with the most vulnerable people, wouldn't you just go out there and do something for them?
It seems like that should be the end result, shouldn't it?
Really, yeah, it would drive us to action rather than
now,
just...
in there, I'll play the devil's advocate here as we go through a little bit. You know, in that initial statement, it says that we want to engage in dialogue, discernment, and action. So they acknowledge there needs to be some action. But this document presents some different thoughts and considerations. I'd like to make a couple notes. One, at racism, I think we all would agree. Racism is an evil. We're not to show preference to someone because of their color, because of their sex, because of their stature, because of their intelligence level. And so discriminating against someone, being prejudiced, being hostile towards someone because of their race is bad. And so we would never condone slavery. It was a sin upon our nation's history. Mm-hmm. And that's one that I think clearly fits. I think all of us would acknowledge that's a national sin of our history, but it seems like it's been largely remedied from a policy standpoint. There's no discrimination against people of color that is allowed in our country. There is no slavery, of course, that's allowed in our country regarding color. The next one, misogyny, had me struggling because I had to look it up, that it means hatred of women. And I was a little bit at a loss as to where they could use such a strong term, and all these people are agreeing we continue to have widespread, rampant hatred of women in our population. And most of the sites that use this term, and we're describing it in our current political climate, were addressing the issue of pro-life and pro-choice.
Now, Brian, let's get something a little bit clear. Are they saying that this is a problem within the church, or just the political landscape, just our country in general?
Later on in the letter, they talk about it being the country as a whole, but then they talk about the white evangelical church is preeminent in pushing and in continuing and not paying attention to these national sins that we ought to be helping to alleviate.
So I guess my issue is, we're not obviously, I guess, to some listeners, but we are white evangelical men here in this room, at least, you know, I think that's how we would describe ourselves.
I guess really we can't talk about this.
So I don't know that we can, I don't know we can talk about it, Brian. But it's, I don't know that, I guess my first issue is accusing the white, the quote unquote white evangelical church of racism in current times. I maybe you can look in the past and say, yeah, I mean, this country has not treated people correctly, and we had some not so great beliefs about race and things like that. And I say we in a very, very, very broad sense of just we as Americans. But I would like for them to point out just a lot of racism in our churches today. I'm not sold on that as a mission statement.
I think the first thing they're going to point to is the quote unquote white evangelical church response to the Black Lives Matter movement. I think that would be their go-to answer for that, which, you know, we would disagree with them, but that would probably be where they're trying to come from. Other than that, I can't really think, Pastor Brian, of really one instance, especially church-related, where racism was an issue and it came out in the news and it was part of a a movement or a landscape that...
It feels like, and I'm sure Pastor will get to this, but it sounds like a lot of headhunting to me as far as the political landscape, because that's a buzzword for the political.
Yeah, there seems to be an undertone here of some political dissatisfaction with the current administration. When you go, this entire document was basically originally borrowed from a document from North Park Theological Seminary and Westmont College, and they say that. And but when I tried to find out a doctrinal statement from North Park Theological Seminary, I mean, I challenge you, try to find it. Mm. And so I even questioned the whole comment of these being Orthodox Christians for the most part. And I'm sure that a number of them are. But when I look through this, wow, I mean, Notre Dame, Georgetown University, Princeton, Yale, not hardly Orthodox Christianity.
Not even
and
more.
I know, Brian, they make it very plain. This is not the colleges speaking.
Right.
Not the seminaries, not the universities. These are professors. But what is an institution without its teachers? That basically is right. The institution. Apart from the brick and mortar buildings. And so I did see there was like two or three faculty from Moody Bible Institute mm-hmm. and Wheaton. I don't know a lot about Wheaton. I don't know that I would call them. Yes, at one time. You're in the 50s and the late 40s. I'm sure it's a very Orthodox institution. I don't even know where they're at right now. There seems to be so much liberalism, you know, about. And I guess the thing that just really, really throws flags all over the place for me is these group of people that are so aggrieved and so troubled and so offended, and not one mention of abortion in this thing. So I guess they don't count. Those babies don't count. But if you're liberal, they're not a baby, are they? They're something, but they're not a baby. So this, to me, it throws it completely out of the realm of anything I would even come close to trying to sign on to, because if you can't even mention abortion, you know, as being the most vulnerable among us.
If anything, a national sin. Hello.
It is a national sin.
It's been fossilized in our policy, national policy, exactly. For almost 50 years.
Right.
That's true.
Well, Brian was getting towards misogyny, so yes. I mean, I think that would probably, abortion kind of probably fits in that.
And they go the opposite direction. The biggest complaint of misogyny in our nation is not giving women the right, or mm-hmm. opposing women's right to kill their babies. And we would see it as the reverse. We would see that it's a taking of a life, and that is a grief. That is a national sin.
Yes. Right.
But it's being turned in the other direction. I guess what struck me as I've gone through this and looked over this.
Hey, Brian, can I interrupt you one
please
second?
Go ahead.
I want to pick up on what Matt said, and I think I speak for all of us. We are adamantly opposed to racism. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think
absolutely.
We all hold the view pretty much espoused by Ken Ham that there's only one race, that's the human
that's right.
race. And so, you know, we're all created in the image of God. Excuse me, go ahead.
It starts, the first item on the list is that, and none of us would disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it morphs and develops into perhaps, I don't know the motives of individuals, but an emotional driven, a current culturally driven mm-hmm. description of what's bad and good instead of biblical. One of those lists of the four things they mention is economic disparity, of that being a national sin. And I don't see anywhere in Scripture where having wealthy and poor people is a sin. Of course, greed is a sin. Oppressing mm-hmm. the poor is a sin. Mm-hmm. And if that was listed, we would have no qualms with that. That's a clear biblical idea and social mm-hmm. issue. But bringing it to the point, stating it as economic disparity, it's a national sin to have
mm-hmm.
wealthy people and poor people. It stretched it beyond biblical concrete ideas to, I suppose, what feels bad.
That's a very sly way to slip a theology in on you know, in that statement there.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, though, that these people then, because a number of these people are maybe like you know, professors of art, sociology, et cetera, and I'm sure then that if they're very serious, they will reject any funding or contribution from Wall Street firms, right?
No comment.
Okay.
Another word that they put in there with those primary four was nativism, and I had to look that up.
Yeah.
And nativism is an idea that you dislike and you reject, and you want to promote policies that go against anybody who is not like you, is not a native-born, long-standing inhabitant. So really, it's anti-immigrant of any kind. And again, it's a conflating between liking immigrants and recognizing we were all immigrants at one point, and our country brings in about 1 million legal immigrants every year, more than any other nation in the world. The issue right now politically is illegal immigration, people who have come not through the proper channels. But that distinction is not made here. It's stated as though all of these people, this national sin, is being against immigration and foreigners of any kind and in any way. And so again, it's an emotional conflating, it's ballooning the topic of the day and the question of the day to turn it into a national sin that I would say does not exist. Obviously, there's disagreement and concern, lots of emotion about the topic.
Well, there, going back to misogyny a little bit, that I have a lot of issues with that, namely the fact that the Christian religion has been very good to women, has been very proactive in bringing about a lot of reason there. And we all know, we've talked about on this program before, the standing of women back in ancient times and how they weren't allowed the same type of testimony in courts and so forth and so on. And we as Christians have fought for a lot of women's rights. And I just reject the notion that we as white evangelical men have some type of woman hate or something like that. And I know a lot of this is coming from the argument of complementarianism, which we don't have time to go into today. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are writing about that today and the husband and wives roles and things like that. And that's a deep subject in and of itself. But that seems to me what's underlying in that statement is that your white evangelical complementarian view of marriage and equality is messed up, and so we need to fix it. That's what it seems like to me.
And it seems like it would be nice if they could say we disagree with that, mm-hmm. rather than you hate women
and it's a national sin
and it's nationally broadcasted, and we need to deal with it.
You know, Nathan, I think it's so significant what you brought up. I think we need to devote an entire broadcast to that sure. subject. Going back to the nativism, mm-hmm. you know, and we can't discuss it in the public, especially not at Berkeley. You know, no. I think there's one view pretty much allowed there. But anyway, if we could discuss it somewhere like Berkeley, you know, or some of these modern campuses, then maybe we could talk about that. Well, we are for immigration, absolutely for it. But we're right. also for our country. So if they could come legally and if they would like to, you know, assimilate or integrate into our society, that doesn't mean that they have to accept all of our cultural norms, but it would be nice if they would learn English, mm. you know, because that basically is our language, you know, in yeah. America. And so I think that's simply what I'm saying. I'm certainly not against immigration.
It's different passages I've heard used, particularly from the Old Testament, that we should not oppress the foreigner. We should treat them as ourselves. And there's a number of verses that say that in the Old Testament. And I researched several in Leviticus. It has the most, and there's others there in the other early part of the Old Testament and in the middle of the Old Testament. But as I looked up these passages, it would talk about treating the foreigner as you would treat yourselves and treat your neighbor, and not to oppress them and not to hold out on them just because they're different and they're a foreigner. But surrounded in every single one of those passages is that the foreigner is expected to assimilate and to follow the laws of Israel. Mm. So we're not talking about people just passing through, people who come and continue with their own pagan and different practices and have come here, in quotation marks, illegally. But they're talking about foreigners in the Old Testament who come in and begin following the laws of Israel and the basic prescription of morality. And so it's in every time in the Old Testament, it's in a context of assimilation and becoming part of the nation, not illegal, going against the laws of the nation, sneaking in, and now we need to treat them as any other legal citizen.
Yeah, I mean, like we said earlier, I don't disagree with any of these so-called sins. I mean, I don't want people to think that we're naive and just, you know, overlooking a lot of this stuff. I mean, those are real present sins, but I guess the problem that I have is just lumping us all together. That's the main thing that I that all of us are, all white evangelicals are kind of guilty of this, and this is the mentality that we've been forcing on people for 50 years. I don't like that stereotype there.
I'd like to quote another sentence or two from this document that is expressing, I think, the heart of what they're getting at and the social issues they feel and recognize, and this is why they're writing this. In the fourth paragraph, it says, "A large portion of our communities is weeping. The fear of deportation is real. The anxiety of being assaulted is real. The fear of being forgotten or mistreated is real. Many people of color, women, and other marginalized groups feel increasingly alienated, not only in the current national context, but in much of the white evangelical culture as well. Acknowledging that pain and woundedness may take many forms, but we humbly entreat Christian communities to seek healing, reconciliation, and justice." You know, there's a lot in there that we would not argue against. If someone is feeling alienated, if they're feeling wounded, if they have a fear of being assaulted, we grieve with them. We would help them in our community. The first statement, I think, to me, kind of helps to clear out the fog of this document. The fear of deportation is real. Mm. And surely that's real. And it's felt by people. But if I have a fear of deportation, that means I'm not supposed to be here legally. Mm-hmm. That's why I would have a fear. And I just thought, when I was a kid, we lived just down the road from the fair. And between the fair, the county fair, and my house was just woods. And a couple times, and I should not have done this, I went through the woods and I jumped over the fence into the fair so I could enjoy the fair without having to pay the fee. But I didn't have the stamp on my hand that everyone else did. And so as I walked around the fair, I kind of had this eerie feeling looking over my shoulder. I had a fear of deportation because I was there illegally, inappropriately. And if someone came and grabbed my shoulder and said, "Hey, where's your hand stamp? You're not supposed to be here," and threw me out, they would have every legal position and right to do that. The reason I had a fear as I walked around the fair is because I had not gotten in there the appropriate way. And that may be a real fear, but that doesn't mean we should encourage lawlessness and jumping the fence, if you will.
You know, I can understand what is being said there, and I can certainly empathize with an immigrant, even though they're here illegally, that they would have fears for their family. But I find a little bit suspect here that why is it just the white evangelical church? So that means that the white Catholic church is, they're doing everything right, and the white Jewish church is doing everything right. It's just us white evangelicals who are the nasty, evil culprits.
Well, once again, it's not coming from any naivete within me. But if you're focusing all your statements on that group of people, that's also racism. Am I not right? I know that in America you can't be racist against white people, but it sure seems to me like that's a possibility. Just I'm just throwing it out there in the philosophical spectrum.
It seems like I said something about sarcasm at the beginning of this episode. And
sorry, that was
Brian's the only one left.
That was probably
give us
little,
what you got, Brian.
Help us a little bit here.
I'll stay where I am. I'm just reading a document here. I'm going to be the impartial. I cannot be impartial.
Yeah.
Something else that stood out to me is through the course of this discussion, through the course of this document, it was brought out that it's a sin and we can no longer ignore the structural injustices. We can no longer ignore policies that denigrate and even endanger vulnerable groups. That's not a faithful option, they say. We have privilege and power to ignore it, but we ought to be involved. And on one hand, absolutely, that we should not ignore our community, parts of our community that are struggling, that are disadvantaged, that are struggling economically, that are having relational struggles. We should not ignore them. We should be involved and participate. And I would say a large portion of white evangelical churches are involved or care, and we struggle to know how to be involved and to what degree. But one of the things that stood out to me was that we should not ignore policies. In other words, we should get involved in the political process and encourage policies that are good and moral and right. And I struggle with this because I've been told over and over again, you can't legislate morality. You shouldn't talk about different positions of biblical sexual immorality, sexual preference, gender identity. You cannot legislate morality is what I'm told. You can't tell people what's right and wrong, let them live their own way. But now here it's being said, you should not ignore policies that denigrate someone or that go against a scriptural perspective, and you should be involved in that political process. I would agree, but I would spend most of my efforts in those things that are clear moral precepts given to us by God.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned a while ago is about how we go about, you know, righting some of these wrongs. And one case in point, when we think about the illegal immigrant and their plight, yet we have a plight as Christians when we literally interpret the scriptures, because Paul said in Romans 13 that we are to be subject to the higher powers, obviously the authorities, the government. And so if the government has established laws, you know, in reference, for example, this whole conversation about sanctuary cities, you know, then what are we going to do? We're going to disobey the Bible, go against our government, and then try to protect those that the government says, no, you can't be here illegally. So it is a kind of a, puts us in a conundrum.
There seems to be an imbalance, a focus on some hot-button social issues that certainly are significant and part of our time. But then not applying that same concept, you know, being involved in policy, being involved in righting the moral wrongs, but then there's a whole other side of it, a swath of it that's ignored. And one of my questions was, as we're talking about national sins, what of idolatry, no-fault divorce, greed, which isn't listed? I'd like to see that word if we're going to talk about economic disparity. Fornication, homosexuality, abortion. These are things that are truly rampant throughout our society and clearly against God's word. It seems like it would be good for us to focus on those as well as these other issues as we're trying, if we're wanting to honor God and live out his kingdom in the community around us.
And that I think is our point, is that this seems like a very pointed statement. It seems like a very narrowed down sin landscape that they've painted here. And like you said, they haven't mentioned any of the other great sins that our nation is, you know, currently involved in.
The sins mentioned are ones that are acceptable to, I would say, the left, the political left.
They also just happen to be a lot of the arguments that were against Trump in the last political election.
Did you notice that?
I mean, that just seems to be an off. I mean,
and if we're going to talk about squelching out those who have no voice, or squelching out the voice of some, I don't know of another group than the quote-unquote white evangelical church that's had its voice nearly choked out several times in the last 8 to 9 years, politically speaking. So, I mean, if we're such a terrible group, then they're identifying that we are a group, first of all, and that we do have a voice, because our voice has been used for racism and misogyny and all this other stuff. So, I mean, it's a very unparalleled.
Regardless, I think the fact that they are painting us this way is a serious thing. Obviously, we'd like to distance ourselves from any type of description like that. I mean, as a church, that is definitely not what we want to be associated with. But there has to be a challenge as well.
The challenge for me, as I went through this document and this letter, and I looked at it and said, I couldn't sign this.
Mm-hmm.
It has lots of insinuations that I would not agree with. I would not go with. It's not balanced in any measure. There's one paragraph full of biblical passages, references to speak the truth in love, to submit to the sovereignty of Christ, who humbled himself to death. Absolutely. To consider others better than ourselves, from Philippians, absolutely. To serve one another in humility. Things that are good and godly and biblical in there. One that made me chuckle a little bit was to honor and steward God's good creation. And, of course, Genesis 1:28, where it says to subdue and have dominion over creation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being referenced here to honor. And that's quite a stretch. There, you can't find any biblical precedents for honoring creation. We're to honor our parents.
Right.
We're to honor God. Mm-hmm. To honor the trees and the flowers and the rocks. I think it's good for us to steward creation and not be destructive. Sure. I'm not in favor of pollution. I'm in favor of us limiting our negative impact on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
But to say it's a biblical, I'm not going to mention abortion. I'm not going to mention other things that are clear biblical mandates, but I'm going to say I must honor creation based on Scripture. It shows me the imbalance of some of the ideas here.
And that's the thing either. I couldn't sign it either. And I think that would be mainly because of a lot of presuppositions. That's what we refer to in philosophy, that you bring to every conversation, every statement that's drawn up is going to have presuppositions that we understand certain terms and understand the way it's written and understand how we're framing the statement. And I don't agree with their presuppositions here, that you have to look past what they're saying in the sentence and say, oh, that looks pretty good, but they're saying it for a reason, and they're drawing this up for certain reasons, and you have to pay attention to that.
If I can make one last admonition, this is something I'm learning more and more as I interact with people who have a different worldview than I do, and I encourage each one of you to exercise this whenever possible, is whenever someone brings up any of these topics, or they ask you a question, where do you stand? Are you for immigration? Are you a misogynist? Are you a nativist? Are you a patriot? Do you hate homosexuals? Whatever the question is, we have to ask, what do you mean by that? Because when I look this up, there's people, when you talk about being a nationalist, there's all kinds of different ideas. There's the Oxford Dictionary, but a lot of people are not using that. They don't really care about that. So when you just say a word, they have lots of assumptions behind it. They have a specific, they may have their own personal experiences that they're thinking of. So we constantly have to ask, what do you mean by that? It's whenever any of these topics come up.
Sure.
And oftentimes, much of the issue is resolved just by people having to describe and define what it is they're really talking
about. Brian, as we wrap this up, most people who sign a petition, as this would be noted as, or a statement like this, it's usually with the idea and the indication that they're going to present it to someone for some reason. Is there some group that they are trying to present this to as far as legislatively or politically? What's the end? I guess my question is, what's the end game here? Just to get a bunch of people to sign it? Then what?
It doesn't have a target audience, if you will, except perhaps us is the target audience. But I think what they're doing is they feel they have a voice here. Different faculty members who are part of a college or university, and they've been wrestling with these things, and they fall on the opinion perspective that they're falling on, clearly, as they sign this document. They're wanting to be able to voice it to the Christian community to let people know that Christians care about these things and Christians ought to be involved and we're involved and we want to get as many people as we can to sign this so that they become getting involved and they take action in this. So I would say the target audience is probably the Christian community.
Well, that's why I asked that, because Pastor and I, we were talking before you walked in and we said, no doubt some of these professors are going to be encouraged to make some sort of donation to this cause. Okay, who are they going to write a check to? Who's the originator of this? Who's going to get this money? Or what's the money going to be used for?
Matt, I think part of this may be the early stages of saying 1,000 Christians have now written or have now stood against the administration in relation to whatever, And so it's been understood, rightly or wrongly, that a lot of Christians helped to elect the current president, whether that's true or not, that's open to be researched. And so now others can say, well, a multitude of Christians have come to say we oppose, for example, your immigration policies or your climate control policies, et cetera, et cetera. Very possible.
Yeah. That's true. But it'll still, if that were to happen, it would still require some representation in Washington to bring this forward.
To lobby this.
Yeah, and that's something to think about as we move forward. Who's going to be the one that'll stick their neck out and do this.
Not I.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We thank you for joining us on Ambassador Talks, where the discussion is definitely outside the box, but always inside the Word. Hey, share this episode with a friend, maybe a friend that's involved in the education community. Get their thoughts on it. I've got several friends already that I'm planning on sending this to, to get their take on it. We encourage, as well, we encourage questions and conversation here on Ambassador Talks. So give us your thoughts on this matter. Email us at ambassadortalks@gmail.com with your question or comment, and we'll do our best to give a timely response and maybe even read your question or comments on the air. Again, you're listening to Ambassador Talks. Our thanks to guest Brian Thigpen for joining us. Thank you so much for bringing this to our attention tonight, and we'll see you next week.